If you're a fan of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, I've got exciting news. I'm hosting a special event for recruitment business owners in London on September 17th and 18th, and I'd love you to join us. If you want to achieve your full potential, you need to surround yourself with the right people. At the Recruitment Coach Live Summit, you'll get to meet some of my podcast guests in person, hang out with us, and share ideas. Some of the folks I've interviewed on the show will either be attending or speaking at the summit. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm joined today by Rachel Philby.
Just because you're connected on LinkedIn does not mean you have a connection with that person. To have a connection with that person, you actually have to speak to that person. You have to listen to that person. You've got to ask them a lot of questions. You ideally need to meet that person.
Rachel has over 20 years recruitment experience, initially working for one of the largest recruitment agencies in the world.
And then I just hit a point in about the October time where everything just clicked. December, I remember having my first kind of top month where I was the number one biller in the UK for Page Personnel. And then my first full year from the January then to the December, I was the number one perm biller in the UK.
She now runs her own recruitment agency specializing in facilities management. In the Financial Times survey 2024, Rachel was recognized as one of the top 150 recruiters in the UK.
I just think that, you know, recruitment's an amazing career, and, you know, I hope, yeah, people continue to go into it and, you know, become lifetime recruiters like I am.
Hey, Rachel, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been, really looking forward to talking to you today.
I've been looking forward to it too. You and I caught up a couple of months ago, and I just knew that I had to have you on the show because you have so much insight to share and so many interesting experiences that I think our audience will benefit from. So take me right to back to the beginning, Rachel. How did you get into recruiting?
Yeah. Well, I actually originally wanted to be on TV. That was, my main aim growing up. And I worked and did kind of lots of PR jobs. I worked for a radio station. I wrote for a local newspaper. But alongside that, when I was at university, I did quite a lot of sales. So I was often on the streets and trying to get people to sign up to charities, selling tickets for clubs. I did loads of door-to-door sales. And I think I just realized that although I think I was attracted to kind of the glamour of the media world, I think the reality of working in the media world, as you probably know, is quite different. And I realized that what I really loved doing was, you know, meeting a random person, quickly interacting with them, and then being able to, you know, especially kind of if you're doing door-to-door sales, like within kind of 5 minutes, getting to them to sign something, you know, give you some money or to, you know, buy something from you. And it was that kind of element that made me realize that actually it wasn't really about media. It was more about people and actually sales that kind of, made me excited. And it was actually my father, who had always worked in sales and ran lots of different businesses and things like that. And he actually recommended recruitment to me and said, you know, he thought that I had the right attributes from different recruitment agencies he'd used before. He'd actually used Michael Page before as a recruiter, and he'd heard about their graduate scheme. So I applied to their grad scheme. I was actually living in Newcastle at the time. I went down to London for the graduate assessment day, had a whole day of kind of role plays and, you know, interviews and meeting lots of different people and things. And then off the back of that was offered the job to start at Michael Page. So I got the job when I was 20, and I started when I was 21 years old. And honestly, have in 20 years never looked back, never ever considered doing anything else, and feel very lucky and fortunate that I do a job that I really love, actually.
Brilliant. I love that story. It's not very often I hear of parents encouraging their kids, hey, you should go into recruiting. That's a different angle that I don't think I've heard before in the show. And unless we have a few clients and also podcast guests whose parents ran a recruiting firm. And so they were kind of like the second generation. And so it was natural for them to go into it. But that's really cool. And So you applied for the job when you were 20. You started properly when you were 21. And you, I believe, became one of the top billers at Michael Page. Talk to me about that career trajectory and how you became the number one biller at Page Personnel.
Yeah. So I joined in the August in the grad intake. So I finished my degree, joined in the August. And between the August and I guess the October, you know, it was hard. You know, I joined a new, you know, company. You know, it was very corporate actually at that time. I had the most amazing manager who I think definitely set me up for my whole career, but you know, he had very high expectations and it was a really steep learning curve. Although I had done a lot of sales, everything I had done had been face-to-face, whereas obviously recruitment, particularly at that time, everything was done on the phone. So it was a humongous learning curve to, you know, take that kind of, I guess, that natural way that I would normally deal with people face-to-face, which had always come quite easy to me, to actually being on the phone when, you know, when you make your first calls and you think that everyone's listening to you and they're not, but you think that they are and all those different things. So once I'd kind of got through that initial kind of couple of months, and I guess the good thing about working at someone like Michael Page is the training is unbelievable. So, you know, I was sent on lots of training courses. You know, you'd go away for like a week and stay somewhere in a hotel and every day would be, you know, kind of a boardroom experience of you know, role plays and learning. And you know, you really, in those days, I don't think it happens now, but in those days, they took the time to teach you things properly. And I genuinely think that's why I've always done so well, because I really learned it kind of bit by bit, broken down exactly why I was doing things, how to go about things the right way. And an insane amount of role plays before I was even allowed to speak to anyone, you know, so you were kind of really, yeah, really trained in your craft. And then I just hit a point in about the October time where everything just clicked. And in the December, I remember having my first kind of top month where I was the number one biller in the UK for Page Personnel. I think I billed about 35K that month. And then my first full year from the January then to the December, I was the number one perm biller in the UK that year. And I think I'm very lucky that I had that initial training and that they allowed me that time to really learn the job properly. And then it was just a matter of me just doing it, which was actually the easier part, really.
Rachel, what a great story. Let me pick up on a couple of points there. One being, Michael Page is known as a great training ground for recruiters. At least it was in my day. In fact, one of my best managers, Mike Dixon, who's now a director of recruiting firm in Australia, came from Michael Page. And he was the one who taught me how to win retained assignments, because I was pure contingency before that. And I could get exclusives, but I hadn't kind of made that leap into getting money down. And Mike kind of mentored me on that, came on joint client meetings, and like he would lead and I'd watch and then we'd switch. And that was so pivotal to my development as a recruiting professional. It's interesting. So there's two key takeaways here for firm owners and leaders. You have to develop your people, right? And that takes time. It takes energy. It takes resource. It takes investment. There's no way around that. Whether you're taking on a grad with no recruiting experience, but maybe some sales experience, or even if you're taking someone from a competitor or another recruiting agency, either way, you need to spend time and effort teaching them how you do things, your best practices, and getting the most out of them. And so huge mistake I see a lot of smaller recruiting firms making is not investing the time, energy, effort in that. But secondly, the good old role plays. We talk about this in our coaching group all the time, because I have two groups, Rachel. One is for the solo producers and kind of sub 5 employee kind of boutique-y firms. And then one for the entrepreneurs who really want to scale and build something that that runs without them being in the day to day. And with that group, learning development and training your staff is a topic that we is a recurring theme that we come back to again and again. And role play, like, you really just can't beat role plays as a way of practicing, rehearsing. And the objection always is, oh, but people don't like role plays. They don't want to. Who cares, right? It's surely you'd rather practice in a safe environment where there's zero risk than have the, like, make the mistakes with real clients and candidates when the stakes are, you know, are higher, right? And so, you know, I want to encourage our listeners to embrace role plays, you know, even if it, whether you're the manager or whether you're the team member, it's uncomfortable. Yeah, for sure. And if you're doing it in a group, you've got people watching you, which, like, is, it's outside everybody's comfort zone. And not only that, but it, it feels a little bit awkward because it's not real, right? And so people are like, oh, but it's not, you know, it's not the real thing. And it really makes a big difference just practicing, rehearsing, thinking. You mentioned media, and it's a bit like, you know, any kind of performance, which really when you're engaging at a high level with clients, candidates, and so on, you want to perform at your best, right? Surely you want to practice before the real thing. So I'm a huge advocate of role plays. So Rachel, you're being very modest though in the following way. You're attributing your success to the training that you had, but surely everybody has gone through the same training. So why do you think you became, in such a short space of time, because we're talking about your first year in the business and your top billing perm recruiter in the UK, presumably others who had the same training and had a lot more tenure and experience than you. So what other factors do you think contributed to that?
I think there's probably a couple of things. I think with the training, I took it very seriously. So I was the person, as even though, you know, as a 21-year-old, I was, you know, also quite wild. I was also, you know, the person who, if I had a candidate meeting the next day, I mean, I would be running through that in the evening. So I think there was that dedication to the job. And I think that I don't work long hours now at all. And we're going to cover that later. But I think at that stage, I probably was the person first in. You know, I didn't have any out of work commitments. So I think I worked very hard at Page. And again, I think this is something I've taken through my whole career. At that stage, you were highly monitored on your KPIs and your activity. Everything was displayed in the league table. I love a league table. So, you know, when it came to, you know, phone time, number of calls, I mean, I was always doing, if not the most, then one of the most in terms of output. So I think it was a combination of the high levels of activity that I was able to do, plus my dedication to doing things properly. And then I think there's probably just something else, which is, I think is probably something which is not as trainable, annoyingly, is, I genuinely love people. I love speaking to people. I love listening to people. I love, you know, and with recruitment, you on the candidate side, you know, when you first start speaking to someone, it's quite a stressful time of their life. You know, they are either looking to move jobs, so they're not happy in their job, or, you know, it's a big moment for them, isn't it? Moving a job. So you kind of pick this person up at this kind of big moment in their life, and particularly also at this, in this current climate, if they're not working, they have, you know, bills to pay, you know, it's a difficult time, and you're kind of there to, you know, build this relationship with them, and to, you know, to help them on this journey and to understand them and to understand what makes, you know, that next role right for them, which is different to every single person. And I think there's that kind of people element to it on the candidate and on the client side that does just come naturally to me. And that's within work and outside of work. And I think it's probably a combination of all those things. The only other thing I would say is I'm very, very fast. So my sense of urgency is extremely high. So often, you know, at that stage, not all the jobs I was working would be exclusive, because obviously mostly it was clients that had never worked with me before. Now all the jobs I work are exclusive. But at that stage, obviously I was proving myself. But almost if a client would give me a role, by the time another agency's even, you know, thought about sending CVs, well, I've already got interviews on the job, you know, that my speed, I guess. And that probably came down to a little bit of my natural instincts. I'm like that about everything in my life. And then also how well I knew my candidates. Because when I first started at Page, because I was very green, you know, I was, you know, my first proper job, between August and kind of October time, I was only allowed to talk to candidates. You know, my boss would not let me speak to a client, quite rightly, because I could have said anything. you know, until I had perfected the role plays of client calls, and he felt sure that if a client called, I wasn't going to embarrass, you know, Michael Page. So that took some time. So, you know, and that whole time, you know, that, you know, 8 till 6 with the hours, I was just on the phone to candidates, you know, candidates. So by the time I then got on the phone to clients, I knew my market inside out. I knew the people, you know, and I think it's probably a combination of those elements as to why I was able then to go on and do it consistently month in, month out. Because I think that's the other thing that, you know, you often hear of consultants, you know, one big month, one bad month, one big month. It's that kind of yo-yo of revenue. And mine's never been like that. Mine has been always been consistent. And I think it's because the activity is consistent, you know, and that makes the consistent revenue, doesn't it?
Okay, great. Great answer, Rachel. Very thorough. So there's 5 things that I picked out there. One was your training was the first thing that you pointed to. But actually, equally, if not more importantly to that, was your work ethic and your determination to be successful in this new job. So you really dedicated yourself to, you know, working extremely hard. And I'm going to circle back to this, because you've achieved a different balance now that you're later in your career. But I suspect that working super hard in the early stages of your career has set you up to be able to, you know, have the balance that you have now, right? And so I'll circle back to that, because that's a controversial one, Rachel. And I remember, you said 8 till 6. I heard that at Page, unofficially, it was actually 8 till 8 were like kind of the expected like work hours. So like you're doing 10, 12 hours a day, which, I mean, compared to trainee solicitors isn't, you know, or trainee doctors or something, but for an office job, that's a lot of hours, right? The third thing that you pointed to was your ability to connect with people, and your real, just, you love talking, but more importantly, listening to people and understanding them. And that is something that you can't really train, right? That is the X factor, in that you bring that naturally through your own disposition and personality and whatever combination of nature and nurture has, you know, contributed to that, right? But that's something you brought to the table. 4th thing you mentioned was the focus on activity, and you were really focused on consistently achieving your KPIs, which in turn led to consistent revenue. And there's a competitiveness in there as well, that you wanted to be at the top of the leaderboard. And so the competitiveness, maybe that's 5, maybe 6 was the urgency. Where does that sense of speed and urgency come from? Why do you think that was one of your strengths?
I have no idea, but I am like that in every single part of my life. And it is a blessing and a curse. I'm learning as I get older to pause and before I act or talk. But I think, you know, I think now, because I now work part time, you know, you have to have a high sense of urgency because you have less hours to get the job done, but you want the same results. I think also maybe the competitive nature, you know, if you do want to be the best, you know, you've got to work hard and fast to get those results, haven't you?
Work hard and fast. So Rachel, talk me through what's going through your head. You get a new job, right? And you feel this sense of urgency, but what are the thoughts and the feelings that go through your mind that stimulate you to take rapid and massive action so that you beat the competition and also you're efficient and you're not, you know, wasting time?
Yeah. And again, I guess I've kind of, you know, perfected this, you know, over the many years, but I think from with the job aspect, it's firstly, you know, can you definitely fill it? You know, because a job is only worthwhile if it's a fillable job, you know? So I think, and obviously there's a lot of aspects that go with that, with the client control and the pushing back and turning it into a fillable job if it's not initially marked as a fillable job. I think I'm excited, to be honest. I think that's probably the main thing. If I get a new role on, even now after 20 years, you know, I'm excited to work the job. I'm excited to speak to my candidates. I'm excited to speak to my client about my candidates. And I'm talking to clients about candidates on that initial call, you know, because I'm already in my mind ticking through who have I got, who's good for this, you know, is that kind of that speed. So you're almost, you know, you wouldn't really put down that job first initial job call without speaking about a candidate. You know, you'd already be getting the client excited about that candidate, potentially even booking interviews on that call. You know, you're moving it straight at that point. And I think, you know, now, you know, I'm very firm that I only work jobs that are exclusive. But I think back in those days, you know, when I was establishing myself, that would be one of the ways that you got the job exclusive. If you didn't get it on that first call, then you try again when you've got the interviews booked. You know, you'd say, well, has the other agency come up? No, they haven't sent anything. Well, I've already got interviews, so now give it to me exclusive. You know, you keep going for that exclusivity throughout the process until you actually get it or you fill the job. And I think, but I think it all stems from, yeah, to be honest, it's excitement.
I love it.
Yeah, to take the role on and to see what I can do with it.
So it's a feeling of excitement. You're excited to work the job. You're excited to talk to candidates about it. You're excited to talk to your client about candidates. So that's one overriding kind of feeling that's driving this. But secondly, super interesting that you are already verbally presenting candidate profiles during the job order or job intake call, whatever people call it, and possibly even booking interviews right then and there. So that's fast, right? There's not like you take a week and then you get back to the client with CVs. You're like talking through potential people right then and there. If you going through in your mind who would be good for this. So that's brilliant. Do you have a kind of standard or target in terms of like how quickly from the time you get the job on, by when do you expect to send the first CV and by when do you expect to have basically presented all the candidates?
Yeah, really depends. And now I do quite a lot of public sector recruitment. And if that is permanent public sector recruitment, there is a process. So, you know, the job has to be advertised for a certain amount of time. You know, that the pace is slow, you know, slower than in how I would work, but that works better for me now because my life is slightly slower with, you know, than it was. But I think as soon as it possibly could be, you know, and that's partly about the clients, you know, how soon they need that person in, and what they've got on, as well as me thinking about all the other things that I'm running at the moment, how quickly I can then work that. But I think in my market, you know, you want to be turning the job within, it's a number of weeks that the job needs to be on and then filled upon, because it's really hard to keep the candidates engaged for much longer than that.
Totally. Okay. That's fine. So it's not like I want to get the first CV across within 24 hours and then it's just, it takes how long it takes, but there is that urgency to keep moving the process along. The other thing I love that you pointed out is in terms of getting client commitment, it's not like you try once and they say, well, no, we're using other agencies. And then you just say, accept that and give up, right? You're revisiting that throughout the process. So if you don't get it at first, then you're presenting candidates and then asking again, and then you know, arranging interviews and then asking again, right? So I love that mindset, is people realizing this isn't binary, yes, no. This is you, if you're determined, I am going to partner exclusively with this client, I need to obviously build trust and establish myself with them first, but like, I'm going to keep raising this issue until we secure that exclusive. Yeah. So,
and it might be on the next job. It might be, you know, okay, this time I will concede and you can call the other agency, but you know, next time, you know, and I think it's that you're working towards that point, aren't you? I think the end goal with the client is, you really want to be, you know, you want to be the person that if they need someone, you are the first person they think of and they're going to call you. You know, you want that call, don't you? So, and to some clients that happens immediately, and to some clients that takes time. But that's still, you know, you're still working towards that with each client, aren't you, of where you want to get to.
Definitely. So I want to talk about RF Recruitment Consultancy and how you run the business now, and how being a mom and having limited time, you know, has shifted the way you structure your work and everything. But so just to finish off on Paige, you were promoted to director at age 27. Can you talk a little bit about why you had such a rapid career trajectory there?
Yeah, I think part of it was based on, I guess, my strengths as a recruiter. You know, I after the first year, it was every year that I would be the number one on perm. I then moved on to temp, and you know, we'd be in the kind of the top five billers on temp. So I kind of proved myself in a number of different desks, a number of different markets, all finance, but different markets and different desks and things like that. And made kind of manager very quickly. Within a couple of years of starting at Page, I became a manager, ran different teams and things like that, and then just kept on taking on more, I guess. So, you know, more teams and more teams and different, then suddenly I had different offices and things like that, and then got promoted to director. I was, again, very lucky to work for some unbelievable managing directors at Page. I think that is the thing about somewhere like Page. You know, you are surrounded by amazing people, and you work for amazing people. So there's just so many people to learn from. So I worked for some really unbelievable people who championed my career, trained me and developed me in all the areas that I needed to be. And they're people who I'm still in touch with now. And things. So I think the only thing I would say is that, you know, with hindsight looking back, you know, I was very young to be in that job. And I think that maybe too young, to be honest. I think it didn't really affect my results. But I think, you know, some of the man management part of it, I do think, you know, having more life experience can help with some of those situations. And the higher up I got, it actually took me further away from what I actually loved, which is recruitment. Because obviously the more people that you manage and teams, and, you know, I had a lot of teams, things like that, the less time you have to actually recruit. That's the part of the job that I've actually always really loved more than all of the other parts of management and things like that.
It's interesting. And that's where you are now, again, is back, you know, running a desk and making placements. But talk to me briefly about this development into a leader, because top billers do not always make the best leaders. In fact, there's so many examples I'm sure we can all think of someone who's promoted because they were a top biller into a management role and they were not suited to it, or temperamentally, or just in terms of even their interest in helping, mentoring, training, and bringing other people along. But you obviously were successful at both. Otherwise, you wouldn't have kept being promoted. What was your mindset towards that? Even though you love the data, the actual billing and talking to candidates, making placements, you still excelled at managing and leading others. So there's obviously a mindset behind that. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think, again, it probably comes down to my love of people. So, you know, I hired a lot of people who I would then train and develop, whether it's training them up to manager or manager to senior manager, or if it was someone more like myself who started, you know, we hired a lot of grads still. So I, you know, took a tremendous amount of joy from, you know, taking someone who had no experience to their first placement, you know, or their first big month, or getting them promoted, you know, that, you know, I that kind of development of people, I loved, I absolutely loved. I think that the bits that I personally found harder were the, when it didn't go well, you know, which is, it's hard, isn't it, in a sales job when people aren't performing, and, you know, that part of it I didn't enjoy. But the development of people, and the team spirit aspect to it as well, you know, at Page, we had a lot of fun. It was a really, you know, fun sales environment. You know, this is pre-COVID, where everyone's in the office, you know, it's a really buzzy sales floor. And yeah, it was definitely, I look back on that stage of my career, you know, that was also pre-children, as you know, it's, yeah, amazing fun and a brilliant, brilliant time. But then you throw children into the mix and that next phase of your life, and you just don't have as much to give, and that level of job, you need to give a lot to a lot of people, and there are lots of people who manage to do it, who manage to kind of, you know, manage lots of people and then go home to screaming children at the end of the day, but I wasn't one of them. But yeah, definitely hats off to the people who can, you know, make that work.
Rachel, you said something really powerful that I just wanted to highlight and make sure people absorbed it. So you expressed that you got as much joy and fulfillment from developing the people in your team as you did from placing a candidate in a job. And so I think that's a question that if you want to be promoted or you're considering promoting someone in your team, is ask that question. Will you get as much joy and fulfillment from seeing your, you know, team members, the people that you're mentoring and managing thrive and succeed as you do from the thrill of doing a deal yourself? And if the answer is no, maybe that's not the way forward. Maybe you're better off just being a top biller and contributing to the overall business in different ways. But if you can see that being of huge satisfaction, then that's maybe an indicator. Really interesting. So, Rachel, talk to me about the launch of RF Recruitment Consultancy, because so what year was this, first of all?
So I launched the business in 2022.
2022. Okay. So you had, I mean, a really quick start, like straight out of the gate, you did very well. So I'd like to hear about that, but also how having a family has impacted in terms of being a business owner. Could you, I don't know what, you tell me the order that we should talk about these things in, because I don't know what order. Did you have kids already? Or
Children first. So I, you know, I've got two daughters. They are now 8 and 5.
Oh,
so in, you know, I went through both my pregnancies, paternity leaves, the return to works and all that brings at Michael Page. And they were an incredibly supportive employer around all of that, which is great. But the, you know, I didn't want to work full time. You know, and I went back after my first daughter 4 days a week, after my second daughter 3 days a week. And I was very clear that I didn't want to manage people anymore. I just wanted to recruit. And at that point, we'd had COVID. So I guess there were kind of a number of kind of different markers in that time period that led me to leaving Page after 18 years and setting up on my own. I think that I'd never really considered having my own business, but I think what COVID showed me is that I could work at home. Because, you know, after having my second child, the offices were all closed. I went back 3 days a week and it was home-based. And that's quite a new thing in recruitment. Before, it was always, you know, in the office, and I had never considered my job to be a job that I could do from home. And I was just billing. I was just literally in my own world, didn't really speak to really many people from Page. I was just in my own world 3 days a week, drop the kids off, and I would just spend the whole time on the phone making money. And I had some of my most successful months and quarters when I was working 3 days a week at home at Page. And I think I then started to think, well, if I'm not getting, I guess, all the good things that you get from working at a big company, like the office culture, the nights out, all those, I didn't really need the training anymore, you know, all those amazing things that you get that you definitely want when you start, it kind of made me think, well, if I'm just at home on my own anyway, why don't I try and do this for myself? And I guess the catalyst was, you know, quite rightly, they, after COVID, they wanted people back in the offices, which I absolutely agree with. But I knew for me that wasn't right around my children. So I took about a year to decide whether to leave Page or not. It was a big decision for me because my whole career had been worked there, and you know, I had an amazing career with them. And in the end, decided to, you know, take the plunge and set up on my own. So I did that. My business is 2.5 years old now. So I think coming back to your kind of the secondary question as to why I got off to such a good start, I think that, you know, I am a planner. I'm very well organized. I had spent a year, although still working at Page, and again, having some of my biggest quarters I'd ever had in my last, you know, few months with them and things, you know, I was already, you know, thinking about my own business, planning. So on day one, when I kind of started trading, you know, everything was done. You know, my system was done. My website was done. I literally was like on the phone at 8:30 in the morning on that first morning, because I had already done, you know, there's a lot of admin that goes into setting up your own business. And I had made sure that that was all done, you know, by day one, so I could just focus on the actual kind of recruiting.
Rachel, can I just interject for a second here? Because I love so many things about what you're saying. Number one is, so often when people are thinking about changing jobs or starting their business, they kind of check out, right? And they're quiet quitting because they're physically present. They're kind of going through the motions of doing the job, but their heart's not in it anymore. I love that you really, it sounds like you've ended your career with Michael Page on a high. You were still billing great numbers and doing, you know, completely satisfying the expectations and requirements of the job while in the background working on websites, you know, CRM systems and so on. So huge respect to you for that. But also, correct me if I am wrong. I my interpretation of what you said is that you were working part-time, but you were still billing at the level that you had been working full time. Did I get that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I was billing more working 3 days a week than I had been working 4 days a week.
That's crazy. And
yeah.
So that has continued, right? I believe you are still working part time. What sort of hours do you work on an average week?
So when I say, if we kind of just describe what work, when I say work means, so to me, work is I'm sat at my desk, my phone is on, I'm on mostly on the phone the whole time. And you know, I am, you know, properly working. I do about 5 hours a day. I always do 4 days a week. I sometimes do 5 days a week, depending on what I've got on. So 20 or 25 hours a week. In half term holidays for my children, I go down to kind of 2 days a week. I don't work in December. I don't work in August. And I take most of, you know, the kind of April off because my children have very long school holidays. So yes, very condensed hours.
Brilliant. I love it. So wait, you take December off, you take August off, you take a lot of April off because there's a long school holiday there.
Yeah.
And during school holidays, when you are working, you're doing the absolute minimum, two days a week. But are there other things you're doing kind of outside of those core? So it sounds like the core 5 hours times 4 days a week, you are really going after it, right?
I'm on working, the phone the whole time.
Yeah. Full out for those 5 hours. But are there other things that you need to do for the business outside of that?
Yeah. So I would say I'm always on in terms of, I'm always thinking about my job. So
when you run your own business, you can't really switch off, can you, mentally? Yeah. It's hard. It's always kind of on your mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, often if I have a job, you know, that I'm recruiting, it will be, you know, I'm on the school run and I'll suddenly think, oh my goodness, that person, you know, so I'm always thinking, I'm always engaged, I guess, as a thing with my desk. And even in the times that I'm not working, I'm still fully engaged. I'm very strict on my work phone that outside of those kind of core hours, my work phone does get switched off.
Oh, wow.
But I do respond to emails and messages on LinkedIn all the time. So, and people know that if it's ever an emergency, like an email, I will go back to straight away, like my urgency. But I am very strict on my work phone. The only time I would have my work phone on outside of those kind of core hours is if I had to speak to a client, or if it was something I really had to do. And mostly that is because, although my 8-year-old respects my work time, my 5-year-old does not. So, and it's the listening piece, isn't it? That I know that I cannot listen to someone fully if my 5-year-old is also trying to command my attention. And that's why I kind of, I'm very, you know, strict about my work phone being on and off in those certain times. But I think that, I mean, I definitely think that when someone first starts in recruitment, you have to put the hours in. I really genuinely believe that. But I think I'm at a stage now whereby the majority of my clients are people who I have worked with for a number of years. You know, I was very strict on keeping to my non-compete contract with Page. When I first set up my business, I didn't speak to any of my clients for the time allocation that I wasn't allowed to by my contract, out of great respect for my last company. But once that time ticked over, those clients came back, you know, they did call me. And obviously I'm able to now recruit for them again. So, you know, I've got a lot of very well-established client relationships that I have kind of nurtured and developed over, you know, 10 plus years. And therefore they also know my responsibilities outside of work, and they work with me within the hours that I can give them. So I feel very lucky to be in that situation.
Okay. So for the time we have remaining together, Rachel, I'd love to learn more about the actual, like the nitty gritty of your process, your what your day-to-day looks like. Because so you filled 7 jobs in the 3rd month after starting your own business, which is like you were off like a rocket. But even just the idea of being able to compress what most people, or even more than most people accomplish working full-time, you're doing in, like, let's say the typical recruiter works 40, 50 plus, right? Maybe 60 hours. You're compressing time so that you're getting the majority of the stuff done in, say, 20 to 25 hours a week. You must be incredibly efficient and very focused during those hours. So, what's a typical day look like, and how do you keep yourself on task and working at that with that intensity? It's the intensity. I think a lot of people who work full time, including me, I put myself, I have a lot to learn from you, Rachel, is because you have the extra time, you, not consciously, but unconsciously, you sort of pace yourself, right? You don't work with full intensity every minute. So I'm going to stop talking now. What's a day to day, and how do you keep yourself so working so focused and efficient?
I kind of separate my thought process and on my business in kind of 3 areas. So it's past, present, and future. So the past is, you know, protecting the money that you have made or relationships that you've got. So, you know, I do a lot of aftercare. I have quite a lot of temps out, so a lot of rebooking my temps. I really try to make sure that if any client or candidate has used me before, that I'm maintaining those relationships. So I do a lot around kind of, I don't call it business development because it's what you would classically call business development, but it doesn't really feel that way to me. But you're kind of keeping in touch with people that, you know, you have worked with before to make sure that they're okay, they're happy, but also that if they need you in the future, they're going to come to you. And I spend probably a third of my time or more, to be honest, on that. Then I have kind of the present, which is jobs I'm currently recruiting, candidates I'm currently working with. That's my kind of my here and now. So, you know, I guess there's a bit of a sweet spot of how many jobs, you know, you have on that you can do a really good job on within the time that you have. And you don't really want too many more than that or too many less than that. So, and that would be, you know, making sure those jobs are progressing. You know, so whether it's sourcing, getting interviews, you know, feedback, offers, you know, is that kind of trajectory of those jobs. And to be fair, I try not to spend too much time in that part. To be honest, that's probably about a third of my time, depending on how many jobs I've got on and things like that. And then the rest of my time is spent on, you know, the future. So it's always looking at, well, what next? Like I have quite a few kind of big accounts, but, you know, if they were to stop recruiting, you know, who are my next clients going to be? You know, what areas do I want to focus on? You know, where have I seen that's been doing a lot of advertising that I need to speak to see if they wanted to use my services? You know, I do a lot of lead chasing because it's my favorite part of the job. So that would be all pocketed into the kind of the future. And I really just try to spread my time across those three different areas. If I've got a lot of jobs on, obviously a lot of my time is in the present, but I will reflect at the end of my week or day and go, right, you know what? I haven't done anything on the future or the past. And then I will reallocate my time accordingly the next day. I think that the main thing I would say is when you work part-time, there's no lingering. There's no kind of, you know, every minute is accounted for. And I actually, when my youngest daughter started school, I went back full-time and I actually realized that I'd have these lulls in my day and that didn't feel good to me and that I am better to kind of work in a kind of crazy way and then stop and then work in a crazy way and then stop. And that feels better to me. So it's activity spread evenly across those different areas.
Brilliant. I like the compartmentalization of thinking, okay, past, present, future. So past is, you know, protecting placements you've already made and also, you know, keeping in close contact with your existing and past clients. Then the present, where it's the deals that are live right now, and then future is business development and where the next job's coming from. You mentioned a sweet spot. How many jobs do you perform best when you like have that number?
Yeah, I can't do anything over 10. You know, I've tried, and I have, you know, had a times where I've had a lot more than that on since I've set up on my own. I think my really five's good because they're all exclusive jobs. You know, that's, you know, you're going to do a really thorough service on all those jobs. Anything over 10 at any one time, and I can't guarantee my service will be there in the way that I like it to be to ensure a great process. And I think that is the danger of being a solo recruiter. It's, you know, you want to do business development. Well, I certainly do because it's the part of the job I love the most, but you can't do too much because you can't get overloaded and then not do a good job, you know? So it's just trying, you need things to be steady.
Yeah.
Is better.
So 5 to 10 is the kind of, you always want to be somewhere in that range.
Yeah.
Okay. And I love the mindset of business development is my favorite part of the job. For most recruiters, that's their least favorite part. And so I love that that's your most favorite part. And the lead chasing that you mentioned, let's dig into the tactics of that. One thing I wanted to put to you, and we can talk about this offline, Rachel, if you're interested, is as a solopreneur, also being a recruitment consultant working your own business, you have a capacity issue, right? That's, as you said, like 5 to 10 for you to deliver at the level of service that you want to maintain. And so what we help some of our clients to do is to put in place a candidate delivery machine that for the fulfillment where they get support on, you know, A, admin and B, sourcing the parts that aren't, you know, well, basically to free up your time to focus on the part that you enjoy most, that you're the best at, talking to candidates, talking to clients, the more revenue generating and strategic work rather than the more admin-y type work. So in terms of lead Jen, what's your kind of go-to tactics there?
Yeah. So where I do a lot of public sector recruitment, most organizations will advertise the jobs themselves, and they will definitely try to do direct advertising before they go to an agency. So I check the adverts every day. So I always know who's recruiting. I always know in my market what's going on, who's recruiting. And then I will, you know, find the person who I recruit in quite a niche area. So I will know the person who's in charge of that, which tends to be a line person, like a head of department. And I'll call them. Normally call them kind of if the advert's out somewhere through that kind of first initial stage of the advertising. I have no expectation on that call I'm going to pick the job up, because they need to see their advertising through. But it's, if I don't know them, it's a, I guess, like a introductory call. If I do know them, it's a, you know, how's the response has been so far? Like, you know, tell me a bit more about what the situation is, you know, and things like that. I will then check in with them once they've, about a week after the advertising. So, you know, how were the responses? Did you get what you wanted? You know, do you feel like you're going to be able to fulfill this role with the applications that you've seen so far? Sometimes at that point, you pick the role up because at that point, they realize they haven't got the right applicants. Sometimes it's later, they've got interviews maybe. And at that point, I will schedule to, you know, have the interviews go. Like, did you get what you wanted? Like, you know, what was the quality of the candidates? And sometimes some places, they, particularly I do some work with charities and things, you know, it's a big decision for them to pay an agency a fee. So sometimes they need to go to market maybe two or three times before they can actually say, do you know what, now it's actually business critical, like we do need to now, you know, go to an agency. And I think it's just that continual process of just being there, basically, as someone that they can talk to. And I'm not pushy in any way. You know, often I'm almost hoping not to get the job because I've got so many other jobs on. But, you know, I guess it's what people in recruitment would call, it's pipeline, isn't it? It's that. So I don't really ever go into a period where I don't have anything, you know, because I'll always have things bubbling or things coming up or, you know, things that I know that are going to happen.
So this is really good. A few things. Number one, you mentioned when you're making these calls, you have no expectation of getting the business. There's no need for you to push. In fact, if anything, you're already super busy. So you are maybe hoping that it's not going to turn into a job immediately. That psychology is so powerful because most people do the opposite. They call when they're desperate for work. That's completely going to you're not going to perform at your best, and you're not going to be able to attract people and really connect when you're coming from that need, right? It's like, it's a bit like dating. If you're desperate to find somebody, you're going to repel people, right? Rather than attract them. And you're calling when you don't need the work. And that is the best time to do business development is you're already busy. You don't need the work because it's so much more relaxed. You come across with confidence and you're not applying intentionally or even subconsciously pressure to the client. And so that's brilliant. Secondly, so you're really keeping close contact. Like, how many touches will you make during the client's kind of advertising process in order to make sure that if they need to, you're the one who gets it?
Probably a call, maybe two calls and an email, or sometimes it can actually also be a message on LinkedIn. You know, it's low touch. It's very low touch. But I guess within that, if it's, I guess, and I'm also only doing it for jobs that I genuinely know that I can fill quickly. And I genuinely want to work with the organization. I think that's the other thing. I think that, you know, I do have to, because I already have a lot of clients that I'm always working with. So if I'm going to add to my portfolio, you know, there's got to be something there which makes me go, oh, do you know what? If they couldn't hire that person directly, I'd actually love to work that job. And I think when I am, you know, whether it's a phone, you know, it always starts as a phone call, but then follow up email, but you know, it's kind of that, like, I really do hope they can fill the job directly, because that's great. You know, if they can, and how great's that? But if they can't, you know, here's all the other jobs that I filled like that recently. And here's the other clients that I work with that are just like them. And here's some amazing testimonials of some of the work that I've done before. So it's very to the point of, I am here if you need me, but also if you don't, that's cool. You know, so.
I like this. So you're not wasting time. You're being very intentional, Rachel. So you're targeting companies that, number one, you would like to work with, and number two, that you're confident you can fill those jobs, and number three, are actively recruiting. So it's a very efficient process. But then with the actual touches you mentioned, so it always starts with a call. Why?
I think people get so many emails now, don't they? And I do email as well, and I do message on LinkedIn and things. So I guess I do a combination of all those things. But I think it's, when I think back of where all of my best client relationships and how they started, they all started with a phone call. I don't think that any of them started on an email. They all started with me picking up the phone and calling them, you know. I went on a meeting actually this week with a client that I've been wanting to work with for a very long time. And I know the only reason I got, I actually had emailed this client before and had no response. And I called this person. And it was off the back of that call, they actually invited me in for a meeting. And I just, if I hadn't have made that call, I don't think I would have got that meeting. I just don't think I would have done.
Yes. Great example. And so there's the call, then messaging, emails, and you mentioned a few kind of selling points that are part of that messaging. So one is, I filled jobs just like this, you know, and you can give examples. I work with companies like this, this, and this. So you're name dropping organizations that in your space that they would be familiar with. So it's social proof and credibility. And you've got testimonials as well to back that up. But what format does that take? Is that in the text of an email? Is it like a marketing document, like a one pager or something? Like, what's the, how yeah, are you no, conveying that info?
It's personal. There's no marketing information. It's you know, I would love to work with you because of this. I've seen that you started in this organization 2 years ago. How are you getting on? So it's bespoke, personal. There's no glossy brochure. There's none of that.
So the information that you shared, you're not presenting all that in one go. This is, you're weaving that into the communication over a period of time through a variety of channels.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think definitely a mistake that people can easily make these days, and I'm sure that I have done it at times and then recognized it and stopped, is I think that, you know, LinkedIn is a really powerful tool, isn't it? But I think there's lots of people or places that think that is business development, or, you know, that's enough. And I think that it's you know, maybe I'm old fashioned, but you've got to speak to someone. Just because you're connected on LinkedIn does not mean you have a connection with that person. To have a connection with that person, you actually have to speak to that person. You have to listen to that person. You've got to ask them a lot of questions. You ideally need to meet that person. That's a connection, isn't it?
Definitely. I agree 100%. So Rachel, if your first touch point is a call, are your calls going through, or are you leaving a voicemail? Or are you then following up with a text? Like, because the challenge these days, and the reason people say, oh, and it's an excuse, but it's based on reality, is that people do not pick up if they don't recognize the number. Whereas when you and I both worked in recruiting, you know, in years gone by, perhaps you had a higher call to connect ratio, right? So how are you how often are you actually getting through to an actual live conversation?
Yeah. So I guess what is quite good with somewhere like LinkedIn is that obviously mobile numbers, you know, a lot of people do have their mobile numbers on it, don't they? So I would always call their mobile. Yes. I never call landlines. Yep. You know, obviously back in the day you did, didn't you? But now everything is mobile. If I have it, I would say, I wouldn't have the exact figures, but I say fairly high, but if not, I would always leave a message, always. And I think I've heard over the years about some places saying that you shouldn't leave messages, which just actually blows my mind. I would always leave a message and then I would follow up with an email. I don't send text messages, but I would be, phone call. If I don't get through, I leave a message and I follow up with an email, and potentially a message, definitely a connection on LinkedIn and a message on LinkedIn. And that was see me as being, okay, that person, I'm now on that person's radar. You know, I've left them a voicemail. I've emailed them. I've connected them on LinkedIn. They at least know who I am. I'm like one step in, you know?
Great. So it's like a multiple channels, but kind of in a burst so that they're like, they can't not know that you're trying to reach them, right?
Oh,
they're definitely
going to
be like, who's Rachel Philby? Let me look at her LinkedIn profile, right? They're aware of who you are and that you're trying to connect. So what's the voicemail message if you don't get through?
Yeah, very direct. So if it's we're talking about the lead chasing, it would be, you know, I have seen that you've been doing some advertising. This is exactly what I specialize in. Hopefully you'll be able to take someone on from your direct advertising. But if not, I'd love to talk to you about what I could do for you. Give me a call. So it's, this is why I'm calling. You know, there's right. no, you know, straight to it.
Great.
Because I think also people are busy, aren't they? They want to know, why is she calling? You know.
Great. Okay. I love it. And then, so people always like to know. And so I'm going to ask you some rapid fire questions in a second, Rachel. First of all, one final question on the BD, like how many hours per week out of your, say, 20 are, you know, what's the minimum future work that you're doing to build pipeline?
I always try and have one day. I kind of get into like the business development zone. So I'm kind of better when I just say, okay, I've done all my job work. So tomorrow I'm just going to focus on business development and I'll just do it for the whole day. But I won't be on the phone for the whole day, but I will be, you know, that's what my aim of the day will be around speaking to clients, whether it's past or future clients. And that'll be my day. And they're always my most favorite days.
So it's one day a week that is you're really focused on business development.
Yeah.
Okay. I like it. So just so we understand the structure of your business, how much is temp? How much is perm?
I now do about 80% perm, 20% temp. Temp covers my costs and keeps my business ticking over on the months that I'm not working.
Beautiful.
And then the rest is perm.
I love that model. That's great. What's your tech stack, Rachel?
So I have a wonderful CRM system, which I don't know if I'm allowed to give them a little plug.
Go for it.
A system called Firefish. It's a recruitment CRM system. Everything is automated on there. It has a brilliant ATS. It links to all, I write one advert on there and it fires across to all my different, different job boards and things like that. So anyone who is setting up a recruitment business for, definitely a solo, but, you know, I'm sure they do big businesses as well, but small businesses, great system, very good system.
So shout out to Firefish then, based in Glasgow. And I used to work back in the day with Wendy McDougall, who's the CEO.
You?
Yeah. We are of a similar vintage and we worked at the same firm and she was a huge biller. As a recruiter and then set up her own recruiting firm and then set up her own software company. She's a cool, entrepreneur. So Firefish, any other software tools that you're using?
No, I'm old school. I use Firefish. I don't use it as much as I should. And I put everything on a spreadsheet because I'm old.
Okay. All right. Great. And then in terms of the perm roles that you're working, do you do retained or is it contingent? And that you've already said it's all exclusive, but do you get money up front?
I don't actually, only because I'm sure I would if I asked, but my roles, you know, my kind of general salaries I'm dealing with is anything from about, 28K up to about 70K. So it's that kind of mid manager kind of market. And it moves quickly. So, those types of roles you're aiming to fill within a month anyway. So I really do push for exclusivity because I need to be sure that if I'm going to put my hours into the job, I'm going to obviously be paid.
Totally.
So, but I don't actually ever feel the need to ask for the retainer because from a billing perspective, by the time I've billed and they've paid the retainer, I've probably billed the perm fee.
You would have filled it already. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it's the speed of the market.
Got it. What's your one or two sentences to request or confirm that they're happy to work with you on a exclusive basis?
So I first of all, I guess I explain that I only do. So I take the whole, it's right at the end of the call.
Yeah.
So I take the whole kind of job brief and explain what I can do and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And then I would say to them, you know, I only typically work roles exclusive. If I say that I'm going to work it, it's my kind of intent that I can definitely fill this role. I'll put everything into it. I already have the candidates, things like that. And, you know, we can review throughout the process because obviously if I don't produce the goods, then of course I can't hold them to it forever. But I guess my hope and my expectation would be that off the back of the initial call, the meeting, and that they would feel confident that I can fill the job and they'd want to partner with me as an agency to recruit the role. And, you know, touch wood, I don't get too much pushback on it, to be honest.
It sounds very confident and just logical in the delivery of that and almost assumptive, like, this is the way I work. This is what that means for you, right? I'm going to put everything into it. I can definitely fill the role. And if in the unlikely event that you're not seeing the quality of candidates that you expect, then of course we can review. But here's my challenge with exclusive is a verbal commitment, right? You're not getting people to sign anything because it wouldn't really, what would be the point? That's definitely worth it. Like every edge you can get in this job, you need to take. And the verbal commitment is worthwhile. What I find where it breaks down is if others are also, like, for example, speccing candidates in or NPCing candidates. And then, like, do you coach clients on what to do in that scenario, or do you just not worry about it? And they say, yes, Rachel, we've only briefed you, and then you just get on with it.
Yeah, I think in the most, I just get on with it. But I have had times where, you know, a client will call me and say, oh, you never guess what, this agency has just sent me this guy. And, you know, so they, you know, because I guess when I'm recruiting a job for someone, I'm in constant communication with them, you know, throughout the process. So they will say, you know, I've been sent this CV, I've been sent that CV. And so it's kind of talked about, you know, throughout the process. But I think, you know, again, I'm extremely lucky, and I don't take it for granted at all, that, you know, I'm now in a situation where the majority of the clients that I'm recruiting for, I have known for a really long time. So that trust element, and to be fair, I have a big client, and they have to put the jobs onto a portal so other agencies can see those jobs. And if they send CVs in, then they do. But I go into that relationship with that job and that client knowing that, you know, and I know that that's out of their control. I know that they wouldn't necessarily choose to engage with that agency, but if they send a CV, well, of course they're going to see it. But, you know, I guess it's the long game. Like, you know, if they then were to take someone on via their agency, I would wish them the best, and I hope that person gets on really well. And that's the way it is with that client. But it's the knowledge of it, isn't it? And it's about not having any surprises.
Surprises, exactly. Yeah. Well said.
And I think anything, you can cope with anything as long as it's not a surprise,
right?
Can't you?
Good point, Rachel. We're over time because I'm just enjoying this so much. Is there anything else you wanted to share or discuss that we haven't really had an opportunity to cover yet today?
No, I don't think so. I just think that, you know, recruitment's an amazing career, and, you know, I hope, yeah, people continue to go into it and, you know, become lifetime recruiters like I am.
Awesome. Rachel, thank you. This has been so much fun. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.